From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We have not forgotten the victims of September the 11th, the last phone calls, the cold murder of children, the searches in the rubble. With those attacks, the terrorists and their supporters declared war on the United States. And war is what they got.
As President Bush announces the end of most hostilities in Iraq, some say he launched his 2004 presidential campaign. We'll take a look at the White House as it battles to keep a report on the September 11th attacks hidden from the public.
Donald Rumsfeld was the only American director on the board of Swiss engineering giant ABB from 1990 until early 2001. What did he know about ABB's deal to build nuclear reactors in North Korea, and why won't he talk about it?
We examine Donald Rumsfeld's ties to ABB and his involvement in helping North Korea build its potential nuclear capacity. And we take a look at Occidental Petroleum in Colombia and Vieques. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In one of the most staged public addresses in presidential history, President Bush yesterday co-piloted a Navy plane onto a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier to declare major combat operations in Iraq are over. Bush did not declare a formal end to hostilities. Doing so would obligate the U.S. under international law to set free an estimated 6,000 Iraqi prisoners of war. It would also complicate the hunt for Saddam Hussein because it could no longer be considered a military mission. Hours before addressing the nation, Bush personally helped fly an S-3 Viking Navy plane onto the USS Abraham Lincoln in the Pacific Ocean as it sails towards the California coast. The ship was bringing home 5,000 sailors and Marines who'd participated in the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. After his jet landed on the carrier, Bush strutted around the deck in a military flight deck, shaking hands with pilots and crew under the shadow of a tower adorned with a sign that read, "Mission Accomplished." The Washington Times reports Bush flew the plane for about 5 minutes. He told reporters it was, quote, "really exciting. I miss flying, I can tell you that." The event was so carefully choreographed that Navy officials slowed the ship down during the day so that no land could be visible in television footage of the speech. The London Independent called the spectacle production the White House might have borrowed from Hollywood. The Wall Street Journal noted the scripted event essentially marks the beginning of Bush's 2004 reelection campaign. The cost of the event to taxpayers has yet to be released. During his televised address to the nation, Bush warned that no more future wars may be inevitable, or that more future wars may be inevitable. Bush said any outlaw regime that has ties to terrorist groups and seeks or possesses weapons of mass destruction is a grave danger to the civilized world and will be confronted. Earlier in Kabul, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld praised advances in Afghanistan. He said the U.S. had, quote, clearly moved from major combat activities to a period of stability and stabilization and reconstruction activities. The Bush administration is naming Paul Bremer, a former Reagan appointee, to be the top civilian ruler of Iraq, overseeing the transitional government. The New York Times reports Bremer will supplant much of the authority of Jay Garner, the retired general who's been in charge of the post-invasion administration until now. Bremer's selection is seen as a victory of the State Department over the Pentagon, which did not back having civilian in charge. Garner, who will now be second in command, is a close friend of Donald Rumsfeld. The Times reports that some administration officials were concerned that the move would look like a setback for Rumsfeld. Because of this, they're considering Rumsfeld announcing it upon his return to Washington tonight to make it look like a Pentagon initiative. Bremer served the State Department for almost a quarter of a century. He headed the counterterrorism department under Ronald Reagan and worked for Henry Kissinger at his consulting firm before setting up his own firm, Marsh Crisis Consulting, in 2001. New York Times reporting the Bush administration and leading Senate Republicans quietly sought to give the CIA and Pentagon far-reaching new powers to demand personal and financial records from the American public. The proposal would have given the CIA and the military the authority to issue administrative subpoenas requiring internet providers, credit card companies, libraries, and a range of other organizations to produce materials like phone records, bank transactions, and email logs. Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee panel said they were stunned by the proposal, which was tucked into another intelligence bill. The proposal was defeated yesterday. The ACLU called the proposal dangerous and un-American. An ACLU representative said, quote, "Even in the most frigid periods of the Cold War, we never gave the CIA such sweeping and secret policing powers over American citizens." It was also revealed yesterday that Attorney General John Ashcroft had used secret warrants 1,200 times last year. The record figure was 30% higher than the previous year. ExxonMobil, the world's biggest privately owned oil group, celebrated May Day yesterday by reporting the largest quarterly corporate profits in its history at just over $7 billion. Exxon's profits soared due to the rising global price of oil, which was buoyed by fears of a supply gap due to the invasion of Iraq. The New Yorker magazine has revealed the family of Osama bin Laden has been a substantial investor in a private equity fund founded by the San Francisco firm Bechtel. Bechtel is the global construction and engineering company that was recently awarded the first major multi-million dollar contract to reconstruct the post-invasion Iraq. Representatives from the Bechtel founded Fremont Group have confirmed the bin Laden family has invested at least $10 million in the fund. California Congressmember Henry Waxman has called on the government to investigate ties between oil giant Halliburton and countries that sponsor terrorism. In a letter to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Waxman notes Halliburton subsidiaries and joint ventures have recently done businesses with firms in Iran, Iraq, and Libya. All three nations are listed by the State Department as sponsors of state terrorism. Waxman writes, quote, "It appears that a company that's performed and apparently is continuing to perform work for state sponsors of terrorism is being given a prominent role in the administration's war on terrorism." Halliburton was formerly headed by Vice President Dick Cheney. It recently won a lucrative Pentagon contract to put out oil wells in Iraq. The U.S. government has hired a TV studio run by pro-Israeli Christian fundamentalists to help produce a new Arabic-language satellite news station that will be beamed into the Middle East to counter Al Jazeera. This, according to a new report by Russell Mokhiber and Robert Weissman. The studio, Grace Digital Media, also runs Grace News Network, which claims to be, quote, "dedicated to transmitting the evidence of God's presence in the world today." The U.S. agency Broadcasting Board of Governors has defended the selection of Grace Digital, which they claim will have nothing to do with the editorial side of the news broadcast. The Indian Prime Minister has announced India plans to renew diplomatic ties to Pakistan. The move marks a dramatic change in policy after a long period of heightened tension that saw the U.S. leading outside attempts to prevent war from breaking out. The London Independent is reporting the United States, backed by Britain, is pushing for, quote, "regime change in Zimbabwe that would see President Robert Mugabe replaced by a member of the ruling ZANU-PF party." President George Bush is sending a special advisor on Africa to the region next week. The U.S. is reportedly pushing a so-called Palestinian strategy. This refers to the sidelining of Yasser Arafat in favor of the new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. The U.S., Britain, and South Africa have indicated that Zimbabwe's former finance minister, Simba Mokhoni, is a suitable interim figure to take over from Mugabe. Prosecutors in the Enron case yesterday indicted 8 more former executives, including former chief financial officer Andrew Fastow and his wife Leah. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Enron, MCI, and HealthSouth are all seeking the IRS to grant them millions in refunds because they claim they overpaid their taxes by basing their taxes owed on inflated earnings. Surprise decision. The Washington Post is reporting that Donald Rumsfeld is planning to choose James Roach as the new Secretary of the Army. Roach is currently the Secretary of the Air Force. Before heading up the Air Force, Roach was a senior executive at Northrop Grumman Corporation for 16 years. The current Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, was ousted last week by Rumsfeld. He had formerly been a high-level executive at Enron. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has suspended upcoming elections in Northern Ireland. He blamed the Irish Republican Army for failing to make a clear declaration that it would end its 30-year war against British rule. The decision effectively freezes the Northern Ireland peace process at least until the fall, canceled voting for a local power-sharing assembly that was to be held on May 29th. The United States was accused yesterday of seeking to undermine another international treaty after it sought special exemptions from a World Health Organization initiative to curtail tobacco use. Anti-tobacco lobbyists and some Democrats accused the Bush administration of having double standards on cigarettes, publicly identifying them as a major health risk here at home, while quietly working to ease restrictions on U.S. tobacco companies overseas. And finally, up to 80 people are feared dead after a bus plunged into a reservoir in central South Africa. The bus was carrying union members heading to a May Day rally.
My mother got us doing suicide singing, oh my God. Yeah, my mother got us doing genocide singing, oh my God. Yeah, my mother got us doing suicide singing, oh my God, oh my God. Slam, bam, I come on the scene, but like gasoline, you can tell I'm in the tank, like money in the bank. I smell appealing, but I'm toxic, can send you reeling without an inkling. Keep you thinking, cause you gave cash to the feds, left your school district for dead. You up in the head, but still they saying nothing's wrong. Selling fire water by outlawing the bong. Still believing the system is working, while half of my people are still out of working. Anonymous notes left in the pockets and coats of judges and jurors.
Oh my God, Michael Fronte here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the White House plots a 2004 campaign plan, administration officials are waging a behind-the-scenes battle to restrict public disclosure of key events relating to the September 11th attacks. This according to Newsweek. An 800-page secret report prepared by a joint congressional inquiry is at the center of the debate. The report details intelligence and law enforcement failures that preceded the September 11th attacks, including provocative warnings given to President Bush and his top advisors during the summer of 2001. The report was completed in December with few details released in the public. 5 months later, a working group of Bush administration intelligence officials assigned to review the document are refusing to declassify many of its most significant conclusions. We're joined on the phone now by Michael Isikoff, who is investigative correspondent for Newsweek. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, tell us about this report.
Well, this is actually the only report that's been done on the events of September 11th. It was the result of a 10-month investigation by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. They hired a separate investigative staff, went through hundreds of thousands of documents, interviewed a lot of top officials, held hearings, some in public, some entirely in secret, and produced this 800-page-plus report last December. But most of it was classified. The leaders of the investigation of the committees, then Chairman Senator Bob Graham of Florida, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and then and now current chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Republican Congressman Porter Goss, have sought to declassify the report, feeling that there's a lot about that they found that should be made public, that is relevant to a lot of the current debate about law enforcement intelligence agencies, and also would tell the public a lot about what was known prior to 9/11 and how the agencies and political leaders performed. They had hoped to have the report out by now, and in fact they've run into a roadblock in the form of this working group of Bush administration intelligence officials who have been reviewing the document and taking an exceedingly hard line, retaining classification for most of the report, and in some cases seeking to reclassify parts that had already been made public or aspects of which had already been made public in public hearings. And this has quite angered both Graham and Congressman Goss.
Talk about the significance of it being Congressman Goss.
Well, look, one could expect Senator Graham to want to make some political hay out of this. He is, after all, running for president. He has made what he feels is the administration's failures in the war on terrorism one of his chief issues, and he believes that and has charged publicly that they are not releasing the report because they're trying to conceal matters that would be politically embarrassing to the White House. Goss clearly doesn't come from that perspective. He's a staunch Republican. He's a former CIA agent himself, and yet, surprisingly, even he feels that the administration has taken far too hard a line on this, and is quite, he called the process horrendously frustrating to him, which was pretty extraordinary under the circumstances.
And Florida Democrat Graham is not the only one running for president. So is the president, George Bush.
Of course, and that is at the very least one of the ironies here. As we mentioned in the piece, this is in the weekly Terror Watch column that my colleague Mark Hosenball and I write every week on Newsweek.com. The administration is the White House political aides have devised a campaign strategy that essentially revolves around the events of 9/11 and seeks to capitalize them on them to maximum extent. They have delayed the Republican convention for 2004 until the first week in September, the latest there's ever been a Republican Party convention. It's going to be in New York City. Bush's acceptance speech will be in the first week of September, and that will run seamlessly into to the commemoration events that have been scheduled in New York City for the very next week on the third anniversary of 9/11. So there's no question, and all you had to do was watch TV yesterday and see with the president on the aircraft carrier talking about the war on terror, that this is going to be clearly a major centerpiece of the president's campaign. And yet, again, this is the at a minimum the irony here. This is the only report that's been done, independent report that's been done about the events of September 11th, and the administration is seeking to keep it classified.
Well, Michael Isikoff, let's take a listen for a moment to an excerpt of George Bush's speech yesterday atop the USS Abraham Lincoln.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001, and still goes on. That terrible morning, 19 evil men, the shock troops of a hateful ideology, gave America and the civilized world a glimpse of their ambitions. They imagined, in the words of one terrorist, that September the 11th would be the beginning of the end of America. By seeking to turn our cities into killing fields, terrorists and their allies believed they could destroy this nation's resolve and force our retreat from the world. They have failed.
George Bush, the first president to deliver an address like this, on the deck of an aircraft carrier. Michael Isikoff on the line with us has a Newsweek web exclusive, The Secrets of September 11th. So talk about the testimony they're talking about classifying, not only classified stuff, but declassified stuff, reclassifying it?
Right. And that's one of the things that most infuriated Goss, that he said, you know, his argument was, look, you've already talked about some of this stuff. I think what happened is, in some cases, the Congressional Investigative Committee ended up getting more out from the administration that the White House really wanted out. And when they realized just how much had been disclosed, I think some people were a bit concerned and have sought to reclassify it. The broad areas that the report covers we know about because there were public hearings and there was sort of broad findings that were published. A lot of them do relate to the body of knowledge and level of concern within the intelligence community during the summer of 2001, and specific briefings, some of them quite chilling and prophetic when you read about them, that were given to senior White House officials and in some cases the president himself in the summer of 2001. There's one I quote from in the piece which talks about a briefing given to the president in July of 2001 that there was going to be a spectacular attack by al-Qaeda in coming weeks, that mass casualties could result. It would likely come without warning. And one thing that was classified about that is who got the briefing. I do report that it was the president in this in the piece, but they were able to sort of keep the headline that Bush was given this kind of warning from the public during the public hearing simply by classifying that information. There was a later briefing that has been widely written about, of course, that was given to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice about al-Qaeda plans in early August of 2001, which talked about the possibility that al-Qaeda might hijack airplanes and use them as weapons. There's a lot about these briefings that has never come out, and this is certainly one of the most sensitive areas in the report that the administration working group has taken a very hard line on. There's also a lot else in the report, including information about the role of suspected Saudi intelligence agents and Saudi diplomats in providing support, whether advertent or inadvertent, for the hijackers, and the role of Saudi financing for the operations of September 11th. That, of course, is also diplomatically enormously sensitive for the administration, which sees Saudi Arabia as a key ally, certainly in the war in Iraq. So, a lot of what the committee uncovered in these areas and others, including the performance of the CIA and what it knew prior to September 11th, particularly about the two hijackers who had been monitored a year and a half earlier at the al-Qaeda summit in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and then came into the United States. The CIA never sort of passing along that information to the State Department to put these people on a watch list, or even the FBI to have them investigated in the country. These are all matters that were covered by the committees. Some has been made public, but how much, we don't know, because the full report is, as we were talking, still classified.
Michael Isikoff, very quickly, what does this mean for the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks? That congressional committee you're talking about, not to be confused with this.
That's the next step, and that's the next battleground in this, and I do allude to that in the piece. The National Commission is also been charged with investigating the events of September 11th. They are just now seeking access to documents, and already there are sort of warning signals that they might be running into the same sorts of trouble in getting access to stuff. The sort of common theme here is the culture of secrecy that has its strong proponents inside the White House, and how much that is going to carry over and prevent publication and full airing of the events of September 11th.
And the former Congress member you write about, Tim Romer?
Oh, Tim Romer, yes. A week or so last week, he sought to go down and review these classified transcripts that the Intelligence Committees had of closed-door hearings and was denied access to them, saying that the White House needed to review them, White House lawyers needed to review them first to see if they wanted to invoke executive privilege and therefore keep them from the National Commission that has been authorized by Congress to investigate.
And
that,
he's one of the commissioners.
Romer. It's not clear whether, I think he's going to finally get access to those documents, but there's a lot of other information that the National Commission is seeking now, and which there are some indications there's going to be some battles over that.
Well, Michael Isikoff, I want to thank you for joining us, author of The Secrets of September 11th and his column on Newsweek's website. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Donald Rumsfeld, North Korea, and ABB. Stay with us.
I just want to ask a question. Who really cares? Save a world in despair. Who really cares? There'll come a time when the world won't be singing fly.
Save the children. Marvin Gaye here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. There's one image from the 1980s that might best highlight the ties between the Reagan and Bush White House to Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. It's that grainy video image of a U.S. envoy enthusiastically shaking hands with Saddam Hussein himself. The year was 1983. The envoy was Donald Rumsfeld, the current Secretary of Defense. Over the past year, Rumsfeld's pair of visits to Baghdad in 83 and 84 gained considerable attention, but he has generally refused comment on these trips. It now turns out, refusing to talk about the possible connections with another of the nation's so-called Axis of Evil, North Korea. A new report in Fortune magazine has unveiled that Rumsfeld might have played a direct role in helping North Korea build its nuclear capacity. 3 years ago, Rumsfeld was sitting on the board of the Zurich-based engineering firm that won a $200 million contract to provide the design and key components for a pair of nuclear reactors being sold to North Korea. The company is ABB. Rumsfeld served on the board from 1990 to 2001. He was the only American serving on the board, and he has never acknowledged ABB's role in building these reactors in North Korea. The former ABB director recently told Fortune magazine that Rumsfeld was asked to lobby Washington on ABB's behalf. We're joined now by the writer for Fortune magazine, Richard Behar. The forthcoming issue of the magazine contains his article, Rummy's North Korea Connection. What did Donald Rumsfeld know about ABB's deal to build nuclear reactors there, and why won't he talk about it? We're also joined by a spokesperson for ABB, Bjorn Edlund. Let's begin with Richard Behar. What did you find?
Hello.
It's good to have you with us.
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, Rumsfeld was on the board, the only American director, from 1990 until early 2001. Newsweek in February touched on this subject briefly, in which Rumsfeld's public relations spokesperson said that there was no vote on this and that Rumsfeld does not recall it being brought before the board at any time. But we were able to confirm that the board knew. And what is particularly interesting to us is that if you check the public record, going back to 1994, when the agreed framework between North Korea and the United States was done under the Clinton administration. From that point forward, until he became defense secretary, you won't find his view on these light water nuclear reactor deal. And you will find views of just countless numbers of his Republican colleagues, from Paul Wolfowitz on down, Newt Gingrich, Jim Lilly, Larry Eagleburger. There barely was a Republican who didn't condemn this project, and not a word from Rumsfeld, which we found interesting, and he still doesn't want to discuss it today.
Let's turn to Bjorn Edlund, the ABB spokesperson. What do you know of Donald Rumsfeld's role in getting the contract to build the nuclear plants in North Korea? Did he have a role as a member of the board?
Hi, Amy. I cannot really give you a definitive answer. I know the board was informed, as Richard has written in his article, because the board is always informed about large projects, and obviously this was a large project. Whether the Secretary of Defense now had a role in lobbying, I don't know, and it wouldn't have been it would have been unusual if he had had one.
It would have been unusual.
Yes, first of all, it's perhaps important to understand the difference between the board structures here and in the U.S. The board of directors is a non-executive body here, and the company is run by the board of management or the executive committee. So, you know, the sort of the insinuation that the board was either asleep at the wheel or whatever are not really very apposite. I mean, the real thing here was, I think, that this seems to me to be a U.S. political dispute more than anything else. I mean, ABB was asked to provide nuclear technology for a U.S. government-led project, which also involved the governments of Japan and South Korea and later the European Union and now two dozen other countries. And the whole idea here was to make sure that the North Korean would dismantle the old nuclear power technology they had and get new nuclear proliferation-resistant technology instead. That was the idea.
Richard Behar, you talk about ABB's efforts to keep its involvement in North Korea quiet. Can you comment on that? And then I'll have Bjorn Edlund respond.
What Bjorn said, one ex-director of the board who we spoke with, the only one who would agree to speak on an anonymous basis, recalls being told that Rumsfeld was asked to lobby on ABB's behalf. We also have Goran Lundberg, who was a top ABB executive in Zurich, who says that he was pretty sure that at some point Rumsfeld was involved, since it was not unusual, he said, to seek help from board members when they needed contacts and help with the U.S. government. This definitely was a U.S.-directed, as Bjorn says, operation, and it was kept pretty hush-hush for a number of reasons.
Most of the reasons being commercial, because you keep things hush-hush until the contracts are concluded. I mean, we announced the contract in January of 2000, so, you know, and explained also the international framework behind it, because, you know, we're not politically naive. We understand that this was a contentious issue, and it's important that people understand why you get involved with a project like this as a company.
Right. And some of the top former ABB executives added that a reason to keep it hush-hush was because they just didn't want other companies, particularly European companies, trying to get involved, which they did anyway, to get a piece of this thing and mess it up. It was a sensitive initiative sponsored again by the U.S. government. Can I add one thing about the light water reactors?
Richard Behar, yes.
There are different arguments as to whether this is a whether nuclear grade bomb, nuclear bomb material can be made from the light waters. It can be made. It's a more difficult process. It's more costly. The weapons themselves, as I understand it, are of a weaker quality. But the reason the Clinton administration went forward with this was because we were on the brink of war in that peninsula in 1994. And it looks like this deal did restrain the North Koreans, who are notorious cheaters on proliferation agreements, from building a lot of bombs. They had a Russian, which they still have, Bjorn, I think. They have a Russian graphite reactor in which it's very easy to get weapons-grade material.
Correct.
The light waters are a bit, are certainly better on that, but they're not perfect. They're not like coal-fired plants. I mean, you can do it.
I guess the question is, why doesn't Donald Rumsfeld say this?
Well, that to me, that's the most interesting thing, is that it's almost, I don't know, it's almost as if the other Republicans were carrying the light water for him on this, if I may use a wordplay. You just didn't hear from him, and he's not someone that generally keeps his opinions to himself on these issues, and he did touch on these issues without mentioning the light waters or the deal. He did a speech in 1998 to the Heritage Foundation in which he took a side swipe without mentioning the words agreed framework. He took a side swipe at it, and he was also appointed by Congress to head a Blue Ribbon panel in 1998 on ballistic missile capabilities and threats to the U.S., in which he took shots at North Korea. But again, this wasn't mentioned, and his role on ABB was not mentioned in his resume, which was attached to the Rumsfeld Commission report.
Can you talk about Westinghouse and what its role is in the building of the nuclear reactors? You mentioned this, Richard Behar, in your Fortune piece.
Yeah, there was a series of corporate transactions that took place that are a little complex. I'll try to simplify it. Beyond, if I haven't done it right, please jump in. But ABB's nuclear division was sold right before the negotiations to sell it took place, just shortly before this actual contract was signed by ABB. There were 5 years of negotiations going on since around 1995. Then in 1999, Westinghouse was bought by British government firm BNFL, British government owned, and that was about a year before it also bought ABB's nuclear power business. So it's now in, the project is now in Westinghouse's hands, and these key components for the nuclear reactors are being, and many of them are manufactured already, sitting there waiting in factories in New Hampshire for shipping, if and when the U.S. government says to go ahead and do it. But about 300 documents, technology was transferred ultimately already to the North Koreans, and there's been a suspension.
To the South Koreans. South Koreans.
Sorry?
Richard, to the South Koreans.
Well, to the South Koreans to provide to the North Koreans.
South Korean companies are building this.
I'm sorry, say?
There's South Korean companies are building the nuclear power plants.
Yeah, that's the way it was set up. And there were training courses done, and the South Korean engineers are taking Westinghouse's technology and training and providing it to the North Koreans.
Yeah.
So it's an indirect route there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Richard Behar writes for Fortune magazine. His piece is Rummy's North Korea Connection. What did Donald Rumsfeld know about ABB's deal to build nuclear reactors there? And why won't
thing?
He talk about it?
Just one thing.
Yes.
I appreciate your interest in this. It is interesting, since the story came out on Monday, there's been no interest in newspapers, magazines, or TV on this subject, and the press corps following Rumsfeld around the world, but they seem to be asleep at the switch on this subject, which is unfortunate. It's an interesting topic that people should be talking about, I think.
Well, thanks for being with us and going on the air. Also, Bjorn Edlund, spokesperson for the company ABB. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Colombia and Vieques. Stay with us.
Según el favor del viento, va navegando el leñero. Atrás quedaron las rucas para adentrar en el puerto. Corra sur o corra norte, la barquichuela gimiendo, llorando estoy. Sea con hambre o con sueño, me voy, me voy. Del norte viene el pellín, que colorea encubierta. Habrán de venderlo en Castro, aunque la lluvia esté abierta. O queme el sol de lo alto, como un infierno sin puerta, llorando estoy. O la mar esté revuelta, me voy, me voy. En un rincón de la barca, está hirviendo la tetera. A un lado pelando papa, las manos de alguna isleña. Será la madre del indio, la novia o la compañera, llorando estoy. Navegan lunas enteras, me voy, me voy.
The incomparable Violeta Parra. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. International human rights groups filed a federal lawsuit last week against Occidental Petroleum and one of its security contractors over a bombing that killed 17 civilians in a Colombian village in December of 1998. The lawsuit was filed in the U.S. District Court on behalf of Luis Alberto Galvis, whose mother, sister, and cousin were killed when a cluster bomb was dropped on the village of Santo Domingo during a Colombia military raid. The suit charges that both Occidental and aviation security firm Airscan helped conduct the attack, providing key strategic information as well as ground and air support to the Colombian military in the raid. Occidental has been a chief architect of Plan Colombia and a lobbyist for U.S. military aid to Colombia, which is currently at $131 million. Dan Kovalik joins us, a lawyer for the plaintiffs in the Occidental case. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Amy, good morning.
So tell us about this suit.
Well, you explained it very well. What we know is that this raid that occurred on December 13th, 1998, was actually planned in Room G of Occidental's oil facilities in Colombia. Some of the planners included employees of Airscan, a Miami-based security contractor for Occidental. Three American pilots, retired military folks from the U.S., actually flew a Skymaster plane that was given to Airscan by Occidental during the raid. They gave the coordinates for the raid to the Colombian Air Force, which, as you mentioned, dropped cluster bombs on a hamlet called Santo Domingo. And again, also participating in this raid was a liaison from the Colombian Air Force to Occidental. So the links between both Airscan and Occidental in this raid are very clear.
Airscan paid by Occidental?
Excuse me?
Airscan was paid by, or the three American pilots hired by Airscan paid by Occidental?
That's right. They were contractors, security contractors for Occidental. And it's also important to point out that the Colombian Air Force itself receives direct aid from Occidental. Occidental has provided tens of millions of dollars to the Colombian military over the years. In fact, it's interesting because last week Occidental, in a statement in response to the lawsuit, claimed they do not give any lethal aid to the Colombian military. Presumably, they believe money is not lethal aid.
And the planes used?
Again, the plane, the Skymaster plane was given, that gave the coordinates for the bombing, was given by Occidental to Airscan. The helicopters that dropped the bombs, by the way, U.S. cluster bombs, were also U.S.-made Black Hawk helicopters that were provided by the U.S. military to Colombia.
You held a news conference a few days ago with Luis Alberto Galvis Mujica, who is bringing this lawsuit on behalf of his mother, sister, and cousin. And let's take a listen. He's translated.
¿Qué sucedió el 13 de diciembre de 1998? Murieron 17 personas, entre ellas mi madre, mi hermana, mi primo.
I would like to say what occurred on the 13th of December 1998, that 17 people were killed, among them my mother, sister, and cousin.
25 más resultaron heridas, entre ellos mi padre, y del cual yo soy sobreviviente.
25 people were wounded, badly wounded, and among them was my father, and I'm a survivor.
Producto de una bomba cluster lanzada de un helicóptero Black Hawk hecho en los Estados Unidos.
This bombing was a product of a cluster bomb that was dropped on my town by a Black Hawk helicopter made in the United States.
Yo soy testigo y sobreviviente de esta masacre. Ustedes no imaginan el dolor, la pena y el horror que cargo en mi mente.
I am a survivor and a witness of this massacre. You cannot imagine the pain and suffering that I carry with me in my mind.
Porque tuve que levantar el cadáver de mi madre vuelto pedazos y el de mi hermana, el de mi primo y el de muchos otros que murieron en ese masacre.
Because I had to recover the remains of my mother when she was destroyed, her body was destroyed, as well as that of my cousin and many other people who were killed in this massacre.
También quiero decirle a Oxy que destruyó mi núcleo familiar. Ahora me encuentro desplazado y lejos de mi familia, que no es nada igual a como éramos antes.
And I would like to say to Occidental that they destroyed or participated in destroying the union in my family, and that now we all live separated and displaced from each other.
Y ahora, de acuerdo a las investigaciones, estos muertos fueron el producto de la participación directa de Occidental, porque de sus instalaciones se planeó el bombardeo.
According to the investigations, these deaths were Occidental had responsibility in these deaths.
Estoy aquí para demandar a Oxy por la búsqueda de la verdad, la justicia y la reparación al daño causado a mi familia.
I am here to sue Oxy and in search of truth, justice, and reparations for the damages that have been caused to my family.
And that was Luis Alberto Galvis Mujica, translated at the news conference announcing the lawsuit against Occidental. Dan Kavala, can you say where this goes from here?
Well, presumably Occidental, as all the companies in these types of cases, will file a motion to dismiss and will respond. We're confident that we will be able to overcome that. And then we'll go to discovery and prepare for trial. And we're confident we can get to trial and as Luis Alberto explained, to get compensation for his family, and also hopefully to send a message to Occidental and other companies like it in Colombia that participating in these types of human rights abuses is not only wrong, which hopefully they would understand, but it's also not going to be profitable for them.
Dan Kovalik, you're also lawyer for the United Steelworkers in a case against Coca-Cola in Colombia. Can you talk about the connection between the two?
Well, the connection is that, you know, we are trying to challenge corporate complicity in human rights abuses in Colombia. As various human rights groups have pointed out, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, paramilitaries, for example, in Colombia, which are doing between 80 to 85% of the human rights abuses and atrocities in that country, work very closely with elites in Colombia, including corporate elites, including U.S. corporate elites, to protect U.S. corporate interests or to act in a way that they view as protecting U.S. corporate interest. And in the case of both Coca-Cola and Occidental, as well as Drummond, who we've also sued, another U.S. company, we are challenging companies' complicity with human rights abusers in that country. And as I said, we're trying to send a message that they cannot get away with this and that they won't and that they will pay for their crimes, and hopefully other companies there will wake up to that. In addition, we're trying to send a message to the U.S. government, which is sending unprecedented amounts of military aid to that country. Colombia is now the third largest recipient of U.S. military aid in the world. At the same time, it has one of the worst human rights records in the world, with about 6,000 political killings per year. And what we want to say to the State Department is, look, unless you can clean this up, stop the military aid, stop these abuses, we're going to continue to challenge you and the corporations that you hold so dear. Let me just point out one other thing in terms of Occidental and oil, which, of course, is a big issue right now because of what's happening in the Middle East. You know, Occidental, as you pointed out, was a chief architect for Plan Colombia. They pushed hard to get military aid sent there so as to protect their pipelines. And in fact, one out of four Colombian soldiers protects oil pipelines in Colombia. Moreover, for the first time, the U.S. has allocated over $100 million to the Colombian military just to protect Occidental's pipelines. And we just sent the Green Berets down this year, again, to train Colombian forces to protect Occidental's pipelines. So the links between corporate interests and oil and the U.S. military aid to that country are close, and we're hoping by challenging those corporate interests that we can stop the flow of lethal aid to Colombia.
Dan Kovalik, I want to thank you very much for being with us, the attorney suing Occidental right now. And we are going to turn now to Vieques. Residents of Vieques are celebrating the U.S. Navy's withdrawal from the island. Fireworks shot into the sky last night, a minute before the official midnight deadline. Protesters broke down a fence at the entrance to the bombing range. Hundreds flowed in, blowing horns, waving the blue and white flag of Vieques. Some took Navy vehicles, drove them to the gate, and smashed the lights and windows with sledgehammers. For 60 years, the U.S. Navy has bombed the island. The Navy handed over 15,000 acres of land with no fanfare, just a written statement. Hundreds of activists who were jailed for trespassing to stop the bombing are now preparing for their next battle, reclaiming lands transferred yesterday to the Department of Interior, which will transform the range, they say, into a wildlife refuge. Well, yesterday in the other hour of Democracy Now!, the expanded edition, we spoke with Rosa Clemente. Now it's been a full day of celebration and activity, Rosa. Rosa is reporting on the festivities for Free Speech Radio News. Can you tell us about May Day in Vieques?
It was an exciting and a joyous moment for the people of Vieques, Puerto Rico, but I think for all the people who struggled, wherever those people may be, to get the U.S. Navy to leave, and for people all over the world to see a victory and to claim that victory. So it was an amazing moment, and there were thousands upon thousands of people from all over the world that were there celebrating with the people of Vieques, Puerto Rico. But with that celebration, there's also a caution, and that caution, I think, comes from the transfer of the land to the U.S. Department of Interior, as opposed to giving the land back to the people of Vieques, and in essence giving the people of Vieques their reparations. And those reparations need to come by giving the people back their land, and also by the U.S. government doing intensive, massive cleanup of the land that has depleted uranium, napalm, and God knows what other contaminants that continue to kill the people, in particularly in Vieques, Puerto Rico.
Rosa, can you talk about the tape we're about to hear?
The tape that you're about to hear was me there in Vieques. I had arrived early and just participated in those activities. People will hear Lolita Lebron, former United States Puerto Rican political prisoner, independista, and just a heroine to millions and millions of Puerto Ricans. Dilcia Pagan, also a former Puerto Rican political prisoner, and just the sound of the people right before midnight preparing, and you could feel it was... I don't know the word to describe it, but you could just feel it.
Well, let's take a listen.
These are the sounds.
It It is an incredible moment. You know, I'm breathless because I have just witnessed, after 20 years in prison and reading news, when you're in prison, you read about news, but to be able to witness history is an incredible moment.
Delcia Pagan, former Puerto Rican political prisoner and filmmaker, after 65 years of struggle, and particularly the last 4 years after the killing of David Sanchez Rodriguez by a bomb that was dropped on him during U.S. naval practices, the people of Vieques, Puerto Rico, affectionately known as La Isla Niña, reclaimed their land last night. Many people here compare this to the biblical story of David versus Goliath. As thousands gathered to await the final hour, reminiscent of a New Year's Eve countdown, the mood was triumphant. Lolita Lebron, independista and former Puerto Rican political prisoner, said that Puerto Ricans should and continue to struggle for liberation.
We're going to liberate the country. We are most sure that Vieques is like a fire that would start a new beginning.
Although the people of Vieques celebrate this momentous historical occasion, many agree that this is just the beginning of a new part of the struggle. Research indicates that the U.S. Navy has left much environmental destruction in its wake, and Viequenses are said to have the highest rates of cancer in the Western Hemisphere due to the high levels of depleted uranium and napalm. Delcia Pagan.
We have to guarantee that contamination will be taken care of, unlike Japan, unlike Hawaii, and many other places the United States Navy has been, and the military. And I believe with the international struggle that we have developed for Vieques, we are going to definitely guarantee that those issues will be dealt with. We have to guarantee that the lands are going to be given back to the Viequenses. And in the long run, we have to guarantee that the development that's going to be done with Vieques is handled and protected, and the decisions are made by the Viequenses people that already has, contrary to the governor's committee for transition, the people of Vieques have their own transition committee who has created an incredible eco-social plan for Vieques.
And lastly, we again go to Delcia Pagan and her message to the hip-hop generation.
There is a victory today, and you know, we have to be able to understand when you fight the biggest, most powerful country in the world, we must celebrate victories. This is an incredible victory, and when we get our lands clean and viable, that's another victory. And when we get the land back from our people, that's another victory. And yes, we must be positive, because if I would have not been positive and understood our struggle, I would probably would have thought I would have died in prison.
Reporting from Vieques, Puerto Rico, I'm Rosa Clemente with Free Speech Radio News.
And Rosa Clemente on the line with us live from Vieques. Last few seconds of your observations of where people of Vieques go from here.
People go and begin to demand independence for the island of Puerto Rico, self-determination, and reparations. And, Amy, I just want to say real quick that on July 25th, which is always the commemoration of the United States invasion of Puerto Rico, we will be showing the video footage. We are going to make, me and my video partner are going to make a 25-minute documentary that will be shown July 25th of this year. And people can contact me at knowthyself72@msn.com, and we will send out a mass email and hope that everybody joins us.
Rosa Clemente, thanks very much for being with us, speaking to us from Vieques. And that does it for the program. If you want to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. And you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burkhenge, Karen Sharif, Abdul Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel and Vilka Tsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Thanks to Uri Galed and Emily Kunstler-Lander, Richard Simbaruso, Gabrielle Weiss, Johnny Sender, Karen Renucci, Fatima Mojadidi. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.